Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of The X Collective. Today I have the privilege to welcome Bas Jorissen, founding partner of Archipel Tax Advisory. Bas, good afternoon, welcome.
Thank you very much, thanks for having me.
Cool, pleasure. Great to be here. Yeah, for sure. And we're going to speak about a very exciting subject. Well, exciting for some, less for others. But I think for founders and operators specifically, this is a subject that occupies the minds of many. And we're going to demystify the subject of employee incentive plans.
I like that.
Sounds amazing, doesn't it?
Right, demystifying.
For you, it should. Maybe before we go into details, Bas, can you provide us with some background of you as a person and what your key motivators are?
Of course. My name is Bas. Apart from, just a guy, I am a tax guy. That's my profession. And I like tax because, for many people, it's just some admin you need to get out of the way. But it's really a translation of policy into economics. And also it really helps, kind of manage what we want to see as a society. So you see that a lot of innovation can be incentivized through tax, giving it a competitive edge. And other things like employee incentives plans can be a good measure to really advance businesses, society as a whole. And that's why I like doing it. It can be a good new show if you choose to address it as such. So that's my motivator for doing this. I really like the people I can sit at a table with as a tax guy. They're usually much more interesting than myself. And that's always good, right? You need to surround yourself with more interesting folk. As a tax guy, surprisingly, you actually get to sit at those tables in that role because, tax is not so much complex. It's just obscure. And I took the time to dive in.
Amazing. Well, that's a great introduction and also a great motivator at the same time for why, you're so passionate about what you do. Indeed, I think tax touches the nervous system of, let's say, the whole operating model and financial model of a company. For that reason, also provides a great instrument to see how you can positively influence both areas.
I like to think so. Yeah.
Cool. And you are the founding partner of Archipel. What led you to found Archipel in the first place?
It's kind of simple. Tax guys are a little bit rare. I think mostly because of the image of the profession. Mm-hmm. There is still a lot of people with tax questions. So in the Netherlands alone, there's millions of businesses and there's about 5,000 certified tax advisors. So, ultimately you can be a little bit critical as a tax guy. And what that ultimately leads to is there's a big gang up on the blue chips, on the really big companies. Yep. But I don't think that is where tax is most interesting. It's really most interesting a few phases earlier where the cash impact of tax is really felt, and it really can make a difference between otherwise good innovations maybe coming to fruition or maybe not. And I think if you're a service provider, your horizon should reach further than your own desk. You should be a little bit connected with the primary sector, looking at good initiatives and the tax hurdle in it. That's where I like to work. Call it closely held. Call it with guys who call them, or girls, or whoever, who call themselves founders over directors. I wanted to work with those. And found that at the big law firms where I started my career, I wasn't finding that, logically so, by the way. And that's when I thought, there's a void for me to fill, and it's a fun void. And with a little process innovation, we can. So really, I started with the business, the three of us. From the start, we automated the whole back office into a single application. And with that, you cut off. You really trim a lot of costs. Mm-hmm. And while still making margins, you can commercially viably advise to even early stage startups. And that just makes you attractive for larger businesses. And those accounts give you some investment room in passion projects. But for me, that whole freedom, being able to allocate my time in businesses that I, in a concept, really believe it's not my place to believe in a business model or not, but that I support. Yep. That for me is the ultimate luxury, and it's what I love, and that's why I made this decision and have been enjoying it ever since.
Well, should it fail at any time, maybe there's a you know, an upside as a storyteller.
Perhaps. Yeah. We'll see how long it lasts. And I'm having fun with it as long as it does.
Super cool. And you know, your motivation to be closer to founders and operators you know, really feeling the impact of your field of expertise.
Yeah.
Is this something that you missed working at, you know, like the bigger traditional firms? Because you started your career out there, right?
Yeah, I did. I can pinpoint quite precisely when I decided it was a time to take matters in my own hand. I haven't told you this before, and it sounds more touchy than it really is. I have a brother with a spinal lesion. And he is, I met a company in Delft and they were making neuro bridges. And I was thinking this would actually be an innovation that I think is, you know, this would be really helpful
good
for a lot
support,
of people.
Yeah.
And this actually touches upon incentive plans as well. And so they were looking for guys who were good at making chips because they needed that to create the bridge between the two ends of the nervous system. And those guys that can make chips, they're sought after by the likes of Philips, ASML, and those are salaries you cannot compete with as a founder. So you have to get creative. So they were saying, we will give them shares. But if you grant the shares for free, they may have a value and you may need to pay tax on the net benefit that you effectively extend. And so they asked a question with the tax authorities, what's the value of the shares? And they named something prohibitive and they came to the firm where I worked at then, where helping startups was a matter of CSR. And they said, you know, this isn't really yet. This is too early stage. This isn't our stereotype business that we invest in. And I was thinking, you know, this is the one time where tax isn't just a tweak to really maximize shareholder value in a larger chain in a multinational business.
It's a critical success factor.
This is critical. And also in a company that I really would like to see, you know, get going. And that's when I thought, for me, this is time to make a switch, because as long as helping early stage businesses is a part of CSR, it is paternalistic and they don't get the attention they deserve. Because especially in early stage businesses, if you are reliant on application deadlines for European or Dutch subsidies and they close and you need to wait until you get your deeds or advice,
yep,
then it's a system that's going to collapse upon itself. And I was thinking, it's good that there's attention for them, but it shouldn't be CSR. It should be
the core.
Right. It should be the core. And that's when I figured, how do I do it? Well, that's, I guess, you know, starting your own business is one.
Mm-hmm.
And from that moment on, that's what I've set out to do.
Cool.
And with that, you know, so want to be clear, I make money with this. And that's the way it should be.
Of course.
Because, you know,
otherwise it's not sustainable.
Exactly. Yeah.
And how did you get started?
I went on Upwork, asked a British lady to design a logo for us.
Classic.
Took a month off work, started writing a business plan for the bank, got it accepted, and took my good buddy and co-founder, Peter Bastian, also known as Piba, and took him to a bar. Got him really drunk to get his handshake on it. And from that moment on, there was no way back.
That's a cool story. And, you know, with Archipel, you know, the core of what you do and, you know, the passion, you know, is super, super obvious.
Yeah.
How did your, you know, services start and how has it evolved to what you currently provide?
So in the beginning, I just needed to make sure that I had clients at all. So I really started out, I didn't really get to pick. I did not have that luxury. So anyone who came in, we helped. I'm not too good for anyone, but some of the projects we did in the first few months, those were not, so to say, very inspiring,
yeah,
but you just need to do it to get the cash flow going.
Exactly.
And to, you know, get some traction and show that the business is there to stay.
Because build a reputation.
People want continuity. If they ask somebody to help them with their tax, it's a recurring thing. And there's also a little bit of time investment to get to know the business. And so it's nice to know that if you choose to stay with someone, they will stay as well. And, you know, in the beginning, you just got to take any opportunity you can. But as time progresses, you can create some content, create some pinpoint some passion projects, pinpoint what you're good at,
mm-hmm,
the elements in your profession that click well in your brain. And from there on, you can start building. And that's what we did. And at one point, you see that you can actually, there's the cash flow to hire people.
Yep.
So we focused on critical mass first, because especially in this business, there's just a there's a big difference between the clients. You can entice when there's 20 of you versus when there's 3 of you. So working on critical mass was definitely a thing.
Yeah.
Which automatically has the effect that for the shareholders, there isn't much much to look forward to. But you know that building the team foundation itself, yeah, that's a really fun project as well. And that's been the main focus so far. And we're now kind of making the pivot where we think we have a good and solid team, full yep. service, and now we're trying to pivot towards, you know, really growing the margins, making it more prestigious. And yep. That's also something you need as a service provider.
And what are key, let's say, projects or areas of focus for the firm?
Yeah, so for us, it's... I think if you think back to the process innovation, I always like to make a bit of a matrix of the tax services market. So let's say we have not so complex, more complex work, mm-hmm. smaller businesses, larger businesses. Small businesses, not super complex, usually very good for the bookkeeper to do. Not so complex, very big firm, usually good for the tax department to do, in-house tax department. Yep. Big firm, big complexity. That's for big law and big four. But then we have smaller business, high complexity. That's us. And so that's what we like to focus on. And where do we see this? This is a common theme in businesses with an accelerated growth background from a yeah. tax perspective that can be quite complicated. We see this with firms that are innovation based. So where the R&D department takes a central element, because usually that also requires some funding up front. You can yeah. be pre-revenue yet pretty large. And we also see this in, inbound and outbound younger businesses. So maybe a startup or a scale-up business from abroad has come to some sort of a domestic maturity and starts looking at the Netherlands. We yep. like to be on the forefront, help, you know, be the beachhead for them. And the other way around as well. When we have businesses that are Dutch and they want to start looking abroad, there's structuring to look at, cap table organization to look at. And that's where we like to work.
Cool. So like you've already mentioned before, you know, tax is probably one of the first considerations if you're looking to expand into a new market. And you'd like to be the beachhead specifically for the Netherlands, correct? Because your scope is Dutch focused. So right. companies that either are located here or that want to expand into the Netherlands for that matter.
Right, right. So the inbound work for me is, that is where... So tax is you can see that as a narrow scope or a broad scope. Mm-hmm. I guess tax is... in itself just tax, but the desk of the tax guy usually involves a bit of the crossroads between legal departments, financial departments, forecasting, reporting. So
sitting in the middle.
Right. It can be broader. So you're a pretty logical guy when a company from abroad enters the Netherlands to help them with a bit more than just, you know, very dry the tax position, but you're usually also one who networks with the lawyer, the notary lawyer, some government people who can really help roll out the orange carpet, those type of persons. So yeah. Dutch inbound is where I can do a lot more, but Dutch outbound is equally interesting because there's just different ways of funding a new foreign office and they all have a different impact. So yeah. either way, it's yeah. fun, but the inbound case is where I can do much more.
Nice. Very, very interesting story to hear. Maybe, you know, if... I think about the Big Five. I think about Safari.
Yeah.
If you think about the Big Five, you think about employee incentive schemes.
That's right.
That's the life of a tax lawyer, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Cool. We're going to dive into the different archetypes that you have distinguished.
Yeah.
That, you know, make fit for employee incentives. But maybe before we do this, like, what is the case for employers to provide employee incentive schemes at all?
So the case, I think, is obvious. It works. So it makes companies perform better. It helps employee retention. It helps employee motivation. And that's not just my word. There's in the Harvard Business Review, which is essentially a peer-reviewed research magazine. Mm-hmm. They have a theme on this. So they have a curated library of all sorts of research into employee incentive plans. And if you aggregate those results, you see that the companies that implemented work, they perform a third better statistically than they did before they implemented it, right? When you compare it to their peers, they work almost half better. And also you see that the employees become more equitable, which I think is a whole discussion on its own. For us millennials, you know, there's a big difference in equity that the boomers have and that we have. And this is really one of the instruments in, you know, making that work together. So the case is very broad. And looking from the business perspective, if you ask any founder, what would you, if there's a wish that you have for your workforce, what would it be? Usually they would say, there would be so much pressure would be relieved if my employees thought more like owners.
Yeah, exactly.
Easy way to do it, make them owners. You know, doesn't mean they have to have a controlling interest, but being a co-owner, working with shared capitalism, it works.
Yeah.
So the case is there. And in a good market, it is a mechanism to retain employees, mm-hmm. especially when labor market's tight like it is today. But, you know, in less positive days like we may face, I don't know, don't want to speculate, it can be a mechanism to ensure that everyone's still motivated, but you don't have to increase fixed costs. So if you share in the results, you're basically all in the same boat.
Yeah.
And it really helps create joint missions. So I think the case is quite obvious. The only thing against it sometimes can be complexity. And that's why you need to demystify. And that's where you come in.
And that's exactly what we're going to do today, right?
Right.
So it's a great tool to create aligned incentives. Obviously, we see many, many founders struggling with how to approach this. Like SARs, stock appreciation rights, are used interchangeably with ESOPs,
right.
And stock options. And there is so much unclarity around the subject. And I think particularly the case in the Netherlands, it's also a bit peculiar. Enlighten us, please. You have defined the big five.
Yes.
Can you make a breakdown of the various types of employee incentive plans that you have identified?
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about the works of them.
Okay. Yeah. So there is endless varieties of incentive plans. So if you want to get started, if you want to break the ice on them, you need to somehow categorize them into some main types. And that's what I've done with what I call the big fives of species.
Yeah.
And I like to look at it as a bit of a genome tree, you know, the way you would in a zoology book. And I would say that under the big umbrella of incentive plans, we have two main subcategories. We have the non-equity based and mm-hmm. the equity based plans.
Yep.
Now, if we take the left stake, we look at the non-equity based plans. We have a KPI bonus and we have what I would call a virtual stock. Basically, those are both instruments that top up wage, where the KPI bonus zooms in on the individual performance, KPI being a key performance indicator. That means an extra wage potential based on hitting specific markers micromanaged towards you.
Yep.
And if we look at a virtual stock or a stock appreciation right, that means that you have a bonus potential that is somehow linked to the value of the business as a whole. Infinite ways of doing that, but that's basically what it is. The first category lets you micromanage specific departments or even specific individuals' goals, whereas the latter category helps you, increase groupthink. That yep. means that businesses, anyone on the work floor, thinks of what's best for the business as a whole rather than what's best for them in private.
It's incentivized on the, let's say, key results of the entire company instead
right.
of you as an individual.
Right, right. So if you take one example, imagine at my business, I can choose two things. I can say you have a bonus that's related to the turnover we have on clients that you originate,
mm-hmm.
or I can say you have a bonus.
Bottom line.
That's derived from the turnover as a whole. Now imagine December 30th, everyone big stress. There's two clients that are sending emails, urgent help needed, and they end up with Mr. X, my advisor. It's a client that he originated. But at the same on that same day, we have an equal question from the company's largest client. A KPI bonus may give Mr. X an incentive to focus on his originated client, whereas the stock appreciation right or team linked bonus will give an incentive to look at the largest client. So that's two different ways of thinking.
Yeah. And, both have their pros and cons, obviously.
Of course.
And the former is a lot more, I would say, easy to implement,
yeah.
I reckon. The downside is that it's very individualistic.
Right.
Are there any other pros and cons to that you can
you know, can highlight?
Yeah, I think the pros and cons to these two are largely the same. Well, let's first say from a tax perspective, this isn't the friendliest regime because both of these plans are implemented through the employment contract, and they the top-up of wage just means you get extra wage, and wage isn't taxed super friendly. Dutch top rate, 49.5%. You know, that's one of the big societal talks we have going on right now. Why is wage taxed so much unfriendlier than return on capital? So a big con to either of these is that the tax, once it's paid, isn't super friendly.
Mm.
Another con to either, so it's that's the same, is if a milestone is hit and it's in the employment contract, then the bonus becomes payable per law and it doesn't automatically link to your company cash position. So without any additional wording, you always need to make sure as a business owner that you don't create well-meant trouble for yourself because maybe the cash isn't there, but the bonus is due. So those are cons to this, to these two types. The pros are super easy to implement. You have infinite flexibility in how you want to create the bonus plan, be it a KPI or a stock appreciation, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's super nice because this is really the lowest threshold plan to implement.
Yep.
Another thing you should focus on when you're doing this is making it visual. Because, bit of an open question, but do you know how long the psychological effect of a raise lasts, according to science?
According to science, I would say 3 months.
No, 2 weeks.
2 weeks. No, yeah, that's
2 weeks. that isn't even until the next paycheck. So 2 weeks is the psychological effect. So if you give somebody a stock appreciation right, maybe it's exit linked. So a stock appreciation right or a virtual stock, interchangeable terms for the same thing. Really what you do is you say, let's pretend you have X amount of shares and I grant them to you today. Company value is T0.
Yep.
When we have an exit, company value is T exit. We multiply that with the percentage that you virtually own. We pay that as a bonus. That means that in the intermediate time, if you do nothing to visualize it, this person is hypothetically generating bonus potential, but they don't know. And that really mitigates the incentivizing aspect. So what I highly recommend is to, you know, get in touch with one of the dashboarding companies that help visualize this. So you have a portal, the employee can log in, and it becomes, you can gamify it or appify it. And it's visual on a day-to-day basis. And so it really helps people know what they're working for.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the efficacy big.
It creates more engagement, I reckon. Right. But still, you would have this complexity, right? It doesn't diminish anything to the fact that you would still be required to pay tax on that, hypothetically, or not.
That is true. That is true, right? Yeah. So once the bonus is paid out, you're going to pay tax. But, you know, getting 50.5% of something very big is still a lot of money.
Of course. No, of course. And let's say in the case of stock appreciation rights. So hypothetically, if, you know, one would get a percentage share of virtual shares in this case, and you would get it at some time and not pay for it, would you then still be required to pay tax on this?
No. So this one, since it's virtual, we're in the non-equity incentive plans right now, and this is all just virtual. So basically, these are just ways of visualizing how a bonus is quantified and triggered, and there's only tax once something becomes payable.
Okay, clear. Well, this is actually a nice bridge to the other side of the aisle.
I agree.
Right? So we have the non-equity incentivization plans, but also the equity plans.
Right.
Here it becomes interesting.
That's where, and more complex as well. So, right, we have the equity-based incentive plans, and those are threefold in my Big Five species tree. We have the employee stock option plan, or ESOP.
Yep.
That is the official acronym for the ESOP. Then we have depositary shares, which in Dutch, it comes from share certificates. Bit of a difficult one to translate to English because it's kind of specific for the Netherlands.
Dutch context.
Yeah, and many countries have a comparable instrument, but it basically means that you place the actual share in hands of a trust, and the trust gives the underlying economic equity right to the employee, but it stays the shareholder. So you effectively disconnect the cap table and the control table. The employee's on the cap table, but not in a control table, because all the voting and meeting rights related to the underlying shares held by the employee are held by a foundation or trust. And for instance, the board can be the board member also of the trust. So they remain in control to the same extent they were before. They're just not on the cap table to the same extent they were before. So stock option plan, depositary shares. And then we have the holy grail all the way down the aisle. And that's actual company stock, full voting stock. That is for the key guys, the co-founder, the important folk.
Okay, clear. And you know, what about the works of them? Like, how is it any different in practice if you want to implement it or manage, for example?
Yeah. So the equity based plans, they actually give you stock. So you have to go to the notary lawyer, and you get a share in the company. So this is not linked directly to the employment contract. This is a whole separate part of law that you delve into. This is now. This is property law. So that means that if you're a company owner and you get terminated, you're not automatically no longer a company owner. Also, you have a say in the shareholder board once you become a shareholder of full stock. So that's a different incentive. It's not just about money now. It's also about having a say, ownership. This is a different incentive. This too has pros and cons, because some people don't really care for this, you know, that's some people, if they get the choice, would you rather have a good cash bonus at end of year, or would you want to be in it for the long run, maybe have something non-performing for 5 years, but have a say and perhaps a big blowout when we have an exit? Many folk would actually go for the cash element, because we also have a saying here in the Netherlands, you cannot pay at Albert Heijn with shares. So, you know, that is something that that you often need to take into account. But the workings of these, if we start with the option plan, that basically gives you a call option to obtain company shares at a predetermined point against a predetermined price, the so-called strike price. And that means that as soon as you get the call option, essentially all company value increases benefit you directly.
Yeah.
At least hypothetically, until you call the option.
And this may create a little bit of an awkward situation also, right?
It could. Yeah, it could. Because in the meantime, you're not actually a stock owner. And once you do exercise, you would become a stock owner. And that is also when the company has a cash out. Because in the Netherlands, the taxable event is there. The difference between the strike price and the share value at that moment is a taxable gain. And depending on your contracting, either the company has to pay the wage tax or you have to pay the income tax. But this may not be linked to a cash event. So you could be taxed on a benefit in shares. And as we said, you know, you can't go to Albert Heijn with shares. Neither can you pay the tax authorities. So that's always something to zoom into.
Yeah.
How to manage that? Usually you would link it to an equity event. But then sometimes people need to exercise, so they need to sell for tax.
Mm-hmm.
And then really they're only shareholders for a very short time, maybe only a few seconds. And then really it's just a paperwork heavy way of implementing what would have otherwise been a stock appreciation right, which basically meant we're going to pretend you own the shares and you get a bonus.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much of a difference, because really from a tax perspective, the real sweets to being equity owner is that equity proceeds are tax friendlier. So the nice thing is once you become the owner of a share at value X, and you have an exit at value Y, the delta between Y and X, when it's a shareholding proceed, tax much friendlier.
Exactly.
So that's what you want. But the complexity here is you need to make sure that the employee can get the share. And if you sell it to them at a discount, maybe 100% discount, the discount is a net benefit. You need to pay the wage tax. So you often create an instrument where they either purchase the shares, but maybe against a loan.
Yeah.
Or you grant them the shares and you have to pay the wage tax, or you create a share that is worth a hurdle share, so to say, that is worth zero upon issuance and only shares in proceeds and dividends from a certain value, usually the fair market value, the moment of proceeds. And that's where you see that there's this.
That's a smart way to approach it, by the way.
I would say. But there's so the real thing here is why do you need to zoom in, and why is it mystifying? Because there is ultimately a trade-off between complexity, upfront cost, and long-term tax friendliness.
Yep.
Those are the three elements that kind of, you know, they work in different ways.
Exactly. But in order to, you know, determine what archetype is best fit for you and how you will implement it, you know, I think it's super important that you also really understand, you know, who your employees are and what motivates them.
Agree.
Because that essentially determines the type of model that you want to apply, correct?
Correct. And I also think that within a business, if you were to visualize your HR building as a bit of a pyramid, then I think that different levels of the pyramid may be incentivized by different instruments.
Yeah.
So let's say your stereotype, super fast moving salesperson, may be really incentivized by a KPI bonus. If they hit certain sales milestones and get a fat paycheck for it, you know, super nice.
Exactly. So even by, let's say, employee profile, you can and should distinguish what model works best.
Right.
And how do you see that especially equity plans are implemented at early stage growth companies for what type of people, for everybody in the company or for separate departments or for specific individuals? What are the common models that you see?
So I think that the equity-based incentive plans are very often implemented for the so-called key staff. So I would say stereotypically you would see a startup business, maybe it's two or three co-founders, and they start scouting for that important product development guy, maybe the head of growth, head of sales, head of R&D. And those are people that usually you want to lock in. So you want to make sure that they have a stake in the business, a reason to stay, a reason to keep working. And the earlier stage you are, the better an instrument this can be.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like the example we spoke about with the NeuroBridge guys.
It allows you to compete with bigger firms.
Right. It allows you to compete. And as long as you agree that you are on the fortnight of a hockey stick in your business valuation, then it's super attractive to become a shareholder. Because that hockey stick then takes place in an equity field, and it's tax friendly, but also it is the ownership that should entice people to stay. And let's say the farther removed from the critical positions and the farther removed in time from the early hires you are, the sooner you start looking at KPI bonuses or maybe virtual stock.
Yeah, clear. Hey, and I mean, all of these people on your cap table can also have a consequence because if one thing, you know, founders like to keep their cap table as clean as possible, especially if you're a venture-backed company, for example, it can create a lot of complexity. What are the consequences for implementing, you know, employee stock option plans in fundraising and how to manage that on your cap table?
So there are manifold. So this in essence is also typecast a change in thinking. So if we think of our average boomer business owner, usually the muscle memory would say, never do anything with equity because you got to keep most of the pie for yourself.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that based on research, but also just based on changing societal views, we are saying it doesn't matter the size of your slice of the pie if the pie stays really small. So based on the research into the shared capitalism incentive plan types, venture capitalists demand it nowadays. So usually between 8 to 10% allocation to staff to the work floor is something they demand because it works, because it helps make sure that people are retained if the company is ever purchased. And of course, that means that as a founder, maybe when you have an exit, there may be a smaller part of the pie that comes your way, but the pie is going to be bigger.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, however, that everyone needs to have a say because the company needs to stay manageable. And that's why the depository stock is a pretty popular instrument because you can give people the economic rights in the company without diluting the control table.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so we sometimes see that even though you're trying to do well and you want to keep things simple, you're giving everyone shares. And that ultimately means that the company becomes difficult to control. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you have thousands of shares outstanding with the company, then a single shareholder, of course, doesn't have a critical say in any shareholder meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But law does dictate that every shareholder needs to be invited to the General Assembly, and correctly so, with enough time to read up on the potential decisions to be made. And the more people are there, if you have a dissident in there, then you give them a tool.
Yeah, exactly.
to not only be a dissident, but perhaps also a nuisance. And so sometimes it can actually be counterintuitively better for everyone if they don't all have a say, because you just become less investable if your control table is super dispersed. Yeah.
Interesting. So these are, you know, definitely things to take into consideration when designing your employee incentive plan. I also really like the highlights that you gave from, you know, the things you need to consider from a cash perspective.
Yeah.
I think, you know, this is something that is quite often overlooked.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. So, mainly in equity plans, it seems like a gratuitous thing to do. So you may not have the cash to give someone a bonus, or you're saying, I'll give you some stock. But, you know, tax weren't tax if it weren't so so needlessly complex. And in that instant, you give something of value. So just visualize it this way. If I were to give somebody 5,000 euros in hand, it's a net benefit if they're my employee. I would be giving them the net part of whatever gross the net part of 5,000 is. So with a 49.5% income tax rate, that ultimately means that, quick calculation, that 98% of the 5,000 euros would still be due in wage tax. Quick math. So this can be quite deceptive and, bad for business. Mm-hmm. And absent a good instrument to address it legally. So this is, of course, something that the whole scale-up industry is lobbying for quite hard right now to make sure that the Netherlands also becomes a little bit more incentive plan friendly, that maybe there can be a lifetime allowance per person, per life, of being able to be granted shares in an employer tax-free, mm-hmm. to make society more equitable, to help business grow. Until we have it, this is what we have to work with. And that means you need to consider your cash position when you implement a plan. So usually what we do is we sit with folk and we first say, what would incentivize the people that you have targeted? And usually that's a questionnaire. We don't ask the business owner, we ask the targets. What would incentivize you? And out of 10 possibilities, maybe that gives 7 preferred options. Then with the business owner, we say, what are you willing to give away? And maybe that eliminates another 2. And then we look at forecasts and cash flow, and we say, what's feasible? And then maybe it's down to 2. And then you start comparing them and making scenarios, which one would work better.
Yep.
But you can only give away equity or incentives once. So it's best to make the calculations upfront, then after the fact. And cash flow is definitely a part of this.
Oh, interesting. Hey, you mentioned something that caught my interest, because you spoke about, you know, the hot topic of debate currently, where the whole start and scale up ecosystem is lobbying for more friendly, let's say, models.
Yeah.
Do you expect that, you know, this will change a little bit, because the Netherlands has a very peculiar sort of ecosystem, if you will, for this, right?
So the previous budget plan, this is, the budget day, of course, is the most important day in the life of any tax guy every year. So last year, I searched the budget plan for the word startup and scale up, and it actually appeared. And that's pretty much the first time ever. So what I do know is that there's a tension for it, and that is for a multitude of factors. It appears easier to acquire an innovative company than allocate resources to innovation within an existing company. That's just how budgeting works. Mm-hmm. And so we need innovation in the Netherlands to compete. We're a high-wage, low-natural-resource country. So really, government policy is geared towards being an exporter of intellectual property.
Knowledge economy.
Right. And so for that, you need our innovative capacities. And for that, you need highly educated persons. And especially that is where the labor market's tight. And right now, the bottleneck in society, well, against the background, of course, of inflation and raising interest rates, the real bottleneck right now is a shortage of hands. We need more people to work.
Yep.
At the same time, we see that there is a bit of a poverty trap going on, because there's no country in the European Union where so many people do part-time work. And so we actually have a lot of locked up potential, but because of the combination between raising tax rates as you earn more and a drop off in subsidies that you can that you can expect once you start earning, the marginal rate is 87%. That's where it peaks, around an income of about 38,000 euros, which is really a median income. So if a person starts working 20% more, but they have to pay 87% of what they earn extra in tax.
Almost doesn't pay.
Right, right. It doesn't pay. So you're actually getting 2.6% more income for 20% more work. And so it doesn't happen. And I do see that this has the legislator's attention. We see this because, for instance, it has become an annually recurring theme to put that table in the budget plan day. What's the marginal pressure on work? What is it? What's the marginal rate? What's it doing? How's it progressing? And the, and it has become an extra target to make it lower. Mm-hmm. So I do think things should change in that. Also, we see that there's additional attention to the fact that, well, as we just discussed, which right now is one of my main selling points to equity plans, that equity returns are taxed much friendlier. But Sander Schimmelpenning, for instance, had a very impactful program about this, where he looked at the cliff between working folk and investing folk.
That's a public debate.
It's a public debate. And this is high on the agenda. And I think that that one of the items that really show that there's attention is the new regime for stock option plans. So where you usually had to pay tax when you exercised the call option and got the stock, and then maybe had to sell some of the stock to pay the tax, you now have an option to postpone the taxable event until a listing. And that means you can be a shareholder in the meantime and postpone the tax until you can actually trade the stock on a stock exchange. Yeah. And then have an exercise for cash in a full market rather than in a limited market, because you may have some blockings that determine who you can sell the shares to or not. And that already shows that the scale-up scene has effectively penetrated into Parliament.
Lobbied effectively, yeah.
It has lobbied effectively. There's lots of work to do, but I do expect that since we are now really managing on a policy level on scale-up lists, how competitive are you? Once that starts, there's no way back. So we got to think it's going to get better, and it can't get worse. So
that's for sure. Because especially if we talk to international founders, they find it very obscure or complex on how this is done in the Netherlands and not very friendly.
Yeah.
What are the key sort of points of differentiation compared to best practice countries?
Yeah.
And who what countries would it be from your perspective?
So both in the US and Canada, there's the lifetime exemption I just talked about, they're happening there. So employee stock, at least in medium-sized businesses, they can be extended under a lifetime allowance. Yep. And we actually notice that in those societies, there's a lot more people with equity in their employer. So those are some best practices. I think that really works. Also, countries where just the tax rate in general on work is lower. Also, we see there that wage top-ups really work. And so benchmark countries around us, some really good startup scenes are Canada, United States, Israel. Those are really guiding places. The Netherlands actually in Europe not doing very bad at all. But that isn't really because of tax, but it's mostly because, well, the ecosystem here works, the access to capital is just a little bit limited. And that is something that's being worked on with a fury right now.
Yeah.
So I really do want to make sure that I don't leave anyone with the impression that the Netherlands is a poor place to start a business. Actually, on a multitude of indexes, it's actually a quite good place for business. Yeah. I just think you need to manage expectations. That's just not a low tax country.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's consistently ranked in the top five countries of doing business, but also from specifically for start and scale-ups, it is now ranked just behind London in terms of enterprise value for its ecosystem. Obviously skewed with a few big household names like Adyen and Booking.com.
Of course.
But it pays back into the entire ecosystem. So it's definitely a good place to set up. From a tax perspective, you know, it has a little bit of complexity. But what would be a final piece of advice outside of giving you a phone call on how to set this up?
So I think that incentive plans too often, and I think also ironically, are addressed top down. So it starts with the founder thinking about you know, they start thinking for their employees. And sometimes you can be really surprised if you just ask them what would motivate them. Sometimes you may think they're just after more money. And really what they, you might get an answer that they're saying, no, I'm in it for the long run. I would be so much more interested in owning a piece of the company. They already own a piece of my heart. Let's return the favor. That can be a super welcoming experience. And at the same time, you may be in a business where you think I need to start diluting because they all want a piece of the pie. And really they can say, I would just be super happy with a little bit more cash. This is rush hour of my life. And just drizzling a few extra euros there would really, really help me. And I'm, exactly. And I'm ready to accept that if there's an exit, I'm missing out on the big bang. It's fine with me. So clear. I guess my piece of advice is, you know, communicate, ask the people you want to incentivize, what incentivizes them. Then start looking at a big five species tree, for instance, and look what clicks in with it.
Cool.
That's the best way to go.
So listening to your employees like you would listen to your customers.
Sounds logical. Doesn't happen enough.
Cool. Boss, thank you very much for the inspiring talk. And looking forward to follow Archipel in the future.
Likewise.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers.